If you would open up to Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17. I know that Brent's already taken you through the first 13 verses of chapter 17, so we're not going to recover that. But I do want to make sure that we pull away with at least one thing in particular. Whenever you think about the story of the transfiguration of Jesus on the mountain with Peter, James, and John, what is the point God was making in all of those events together? He had one major point. What was it? Listen to him. In God's statement about his son, he says, "This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." What you're going to find through the rest of chapter 17, it's as if there's a nail that's already been driven deeply into the wood and into the concrete. And you're just going to see God just take another swing at it over and over and over again to go, what about listening to Jesus? Now, as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus was describing to Peter, James, and John about Elijah and what they asked and what they questioned. And finally, as they're coming down the mountain, this realization hits that John the Baptist is Elijah, the Elijah of Malachi, the Elijah of the Old Testament that had been talked about in these prophecies. And they go, things are starting to begin to click in the minds of some of the apostles. And now, the point of view that Peter, James, and John are going to have about these next events that take place are going to be different than the other nine who were not there on the Mount of Transfiguration. They didn't hear what God had to say about his son being, number one, his beloved son. Number two, being well-pleasing. This is what well-pleasing looks like in the life of Jesus. And number three, you better listen up, or else things are going to take a dramatic turn in a negative way. Verse 14, all of a sudden, nothing like showing up to problems. I'm sure all of you as mothers or grandmothers or friends have shown up at a situation where it's already a mess in the moment that you get there. And all of a sudden, you have to iron things out and you have to take care of things. Well, look at what's here. Look at verse 14. When they came to the crowd, a man came up to Jesus, falling on his knees before him and saying, and I'm going to leave you a cliffhanger here for a second. Notice the way it's laid out here. They came to the crowd, they being Jesus, Peter, James, and John, coming down the mountain. So you imagine, as they're coming down, you can see what's going on at the base of the mountain. And all of a sudden, there's this big crowd. Nothing like coming back to a humongous crowd. And as part of this crowd, you know it's pretty large, number one. Number two, you know the other nine apostles are part of this crowd because we're going to run into them. There's a father that's part of this crowd who has a son that he's going to refer to as a lunatic. And then there's these other people who are just standing around, either waiting on Jesus or encountering the apostles or something along those lines. Immediately as Jesus is coming down the mountain with the other three, it says, a man came up to Jesus. What do you hear in that? Was he willing to wait for Jesus to come all the way down the mountain? Notice the way he talks about it. And the man came up to Jesus. So Jesus is still on his way down the mountain, and this man sees Jesus, and he leaves the crowd, and he comes up, however the distance, we don't know. But he comes up to Jesus. He says, you're the one I want to talk to. And so he came up to Jesus, and when he gets close, now what does he do? Falls on his knees. So what does that tell you about this man, just from the get-go? He recognizes Jesus. He knows that Jesus stands in control over something, and he humbles himself to fall down before him. Now, we just don't live in a culture that does this in general. To fall down before somebody, to show, I'm here to listen. So I'm here to learn. I'm here to do these things. Even the idea of taking a knee is kind of a still a far-fetched idea in our day and time. But notice the point here. Falling on his knees before him. Notice both knees are on the ground. He says, in saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic and is very ill, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water. I brought him to your disciples, and they could not cure him. Now, in verse 15, notice what he's saying here. And this is a, make sure you see these words correctly. Lord, I'm here to listen. He's referring to him as Lord. Lord over. And really, if you see what he says, he's saying, you're Lord over what? What does he stand in control of? Sickness, healing, this unclean spirit or this demon of going, you stand in control over these things. Now, he says, for my son is a lunatic. Now, I want you to realize what that's really tied to. When you hear the term luna, what do you think of, especially these days? The moon. Yeah. Some, you might even have a footnote that says moonstruck. In other words, all of a sudden, it's like these things happen under the full moon. Or maybe they happen under a new moon. But you realize they're making these things tied to, oh, man, he's just crazy whenever these things happen. And that's where the term lunatic comes from, by the way. It's about seeing the phases of the moon and thinking that whenever it's full, that's whenever crazy things happen. And people still think that way, don't they? Right. And what's something is if you look at the parallel accounts in Mark 9 and in Luke 9, it'll specifically bring out that statement about having seizures. We would think of, like, I'm not going to say epileptic seizures because people will make an association about, oh, is epilepsy a demon? No, it's not. Don't think that way. But seeing here at this point, and sometimes things get thrown in that are really garnished from other accounts. So you see what's going on. He says he's a lunatic and is very ill. He is sick. Now, think about the way people talk about mental illness nowadays. Oh, they're very sick. And you go, oh, we don't think about it that way. Then he says, and this is what this lunatic does. That's a son of his. He says he often falls into the fire and often into the water. Now, if you want to read more about this story, you get a far more complete telling of it in Mark chapter 9. And it goes much, much further into some details about how this has happened to him for a long time. It also refers to him as being mute, that he can't talk. And these evil spirits or unclean spirits or demons throw him into the fire. You imagine being thrown into the fire and you can't make a sound. Oh, what would that do to a parent? You want to be there to protect your kid. You'd have to be on high alert all the time. No. Which tells you where this father's been and what he's done. So this man, you think about it, if he often falls into the fire, how's his skin look? I mean, have you seen somebody that has severe burns? And you go, he doesn't look like just your typical human being. He's got these burns on his body, and your heart goes out to him already. He says, and often he's thrown into the water. And you go, ooh. Being thrown into the water. Can he swim? Can he not swim? Don't know. But you get this picture. But verse 16, I brought him to your disciples and they could not cure him. Now, it doesn't say that they would not. It says they could not. Now, real quickly, look back at Matthew chapter 10, because maybe you're already thinking this, but we'll go ahead and point it out. Just so you know, chronologically, Matthew chapter 10 comes before Matthew chapter 17. Doesn't that seem pretty obvious to us? I know you're thinking, boy, that Carrie Terry, he knows some things. But look here at verse 1. This is whenever Jesus first calls the 12. It says, Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over what? unclean spirits. And what could they do with unclean spirits? They can cast them out. And also to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. So, had Jesus granted that they could do this? Yes. So then why in the world over here in Matthew chapter 17, and you read verse 16, and it says, I brought him to your disciples, and they could not cure him. Doesn't that seem odd? Jesus gave them the authority to do it, but now that they need to do it, they can't do it. And yet in other stories that we've read in between these two spots in Matthew, they were doing this. So this is kind of one of those stories that kind of just makes you go, what's going on here? This doesn't really make sense. Here's something to learn. Is this demon going to listen to them? It is not. Now, here in a little bit, Jesus is going to explain why. It doesn't leave us hanging. Because Matthew knows you're going to have a question on this. Because here's another aspect of this. Who is at the bottom of the mountain who had encountered this guy? Matthew. He's one of the apostles. He wasn't up on the Mount of Transfiguration with Peter, James, and John and Jesus. And so now here's Matthew telling you, we tried. We could not do it. And he's going to go on, inspired by the Spirit of God, to tell you why here in a little bit. Now, he says, I brought him to your disciples and they could not cure him. And that's why I'm here climbing up the mountain on my knees asking you, because they're insufficient. You, Lord, are not. Verse 17. Look at Jesus' response to this. This is probably not what you would expect. If this was a fill in the blank on what you expect Jesus to do next, I don't think we would get verse 17 as our guess. But this is what he does. And Jesus answered and said, you unbelieving and perverted generation. Ooh, what a moment of compassion. Now, this is a moment to teach, is what this is. So oftentimes, we just want to show compassion, and we never really engage in the teaching aspect of Jesus. Now, we can be way too harsh sometimes, but I want you to see the reason why he does this. All right, we're going to go back to simple English. And. What does the word and mean? Also, it's, you know, in English they call it a conjunction. It's supposed to bring two ideas together, right? What are the two ideas that Jesus is bringing together? What are the terms he uses? Unbelieving and perverted. Now, before we get too far, Judy, just hold on a second. Whenever you think about unbelieving, I want you to know that this word for unbelieving is not a verb, and it's not a participle. It's just an adjective. Whenever you don't believe me, the next thing that comes together with it is perversion. And what happens is you're not believing what I'm saying. And so since you're not going to trust me, Jesus, what happens to everything else how you see it? It becomes twisted. It becomes perverted. Now, don't think him here talking about perversion like some kind of sexual thing. He's not going that direction. This is when you don't believe me. Think about where Peter, James, and John have been. Listen to him. What happens, and Peter, James, and John are getting a little different learning here. If you don't listen to Jesus and you're unbelieving, what's the next outcome? You get a twisted, perverted point of view. Now, just roll with this idea for a second with me. What does Jesus want us to do with all bitterness? lay it aside. I mean, it comes up in Ephesians chapter 4. Lay aside all bitterness. But if you don't believe that, what happens to your thinking next? It's going to be perverted. And how does that thinking go? If I go, I'm not going to believe Jesus that I'm supposed to let go of a bitterness, all of a sudden, what do I start to find justification for? For being bitter. And here's why it's okay for me to be bitter. Here's the way I've been treated, I can be bitter. And how does your thinking go? It gets perverted. And you're still claiming to listen to who? To Jesus. That tells you how perverted it's become. I mean, how much poison do you add to the water and still say it's okay? So Jesus is encountering them with, like I said, Peter, James, and John are getting a different lesson in this than the Father is and what the crowd is getting. So here's Jesus. He's saying, if you're not going to listen to me, if you're going to be unbelieving, just know that your thinking is going to be twisted and it's going to be perverted. And also notice this, how long shall I be with you? How many opportunities are you going to get? Don't see this as Jesus going, oh, I'm tired of this. Forget it. I'm going to grow impatient. You know he's patient. But he's saying, you need to understand, if you're not going to listen to me, you're only going to have so many opportunities. And you're going to destroy a lot really quickly. Now, kind of finish this out. How long shall I put up with you? What does that tell you about the tolerance of Jesus? He's long-suffering, which should also tell us something about how we need to be. What about when people are unbelieving? Do we need to be willing to go, all right, you know, how long am I going to have to tolerate this? But notice there is a tolerance. And then he says, bring him here to me. Now, I want you to notice he says, unbelieving and perverted generation. This is not just this father. This is not just the apostles. This is not just the crowd. This is generation. What kind of generation do you think we live in? Unbelieving and perverted. How many things do you hear that are claimed to be said by Jesus that don't show a true faith response to his words, that don't really listen to him? And yet people trust it. And you realize, here's what it's coming back to. Judy. Yeah, right. It's a whole generation aspect, and specifically talking to this father, and there's at least three apostles who can listen in terms of Peter, James, and John, because remember, Jesus is, this father has come up the mountain some ways. So, yeah. He'll deal with them specifically by themselves. They don't have that capability. Right. But this is the statement that is about the whole generation. He's going to have a special application when he comes to those nine. And there's going to be a side application to the other three. So you see what's here in verse 17. Then verse 18. He says, bring him here to me. And I want you to think about this. What are you supposed to do with the words of Jesus? Listen to him. After the statement in verse 17, the thing that the Father needed to hear was what? Bring him here to me. Now, if he doesn't bring him, what do you expect? Nothing. verse 18. And Jesus rebuked him, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was cured at once. Who listened to Jesus? The father did, and the demon did, and the boy, you can include that. You go, demon listens to Jesus. I want you to think about that. What has he just talked about with this whole generation? They're unbelieving, and because they don't trust my words, they get a perverted outcome in their thinking and their reasoning. They won't listen. The demon will. Now, the demon doesn't necessarily listen because it wants to. I'm not saying that that's there. But it probably also makes you think about the statement that James writes about. And James, also being an apostle, I want you to think about this one. And where is James in this story? Peter, James, and John coming down the mountain with Jesus, having just heard, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." And in James chapter 2, James says, even the demons believe and they shudder or tremble. Like, they're so scared they shake. James, understand that? He saw it. He saw it. James understood. You better listen to Jesus. Demons listen to Jesus. And I want you to think about this for half a second. If a demon listens to Jesus and I don't listen to Jesus, where does that put me? Worse than a demon. Worse than an unclean spirit. Who wants to have a spiritual existence like that? Anybody? Because what's the outcome for the demons? There's a place reserved for the devil and his angels. And to go, and if I'm not even doing that good, did God mean what he said on the mount? He says, listen to him. He doesn't mean, yeah, you know, just pay a little attention. He's saying, no, you better listen to them like something that's going to change your life completely. Now, notice, if you notice the statement it makes at the end of verse 18, and Jesus rebuked him, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was cured at just that fast. Here he was. All at once. The demon didn't go, I hear what you're saying, but I don't know. You go, how devoted should we be as God's people to the words of Jesus at once? Now, you also know there are times we just don't understand things. But whenever we do understand it, we had better not wait. I mean, I told my kids a lot growing up, lived by a busy street. I said, there's one thing I want you to know. If I tell you to stop, I mean stop that moment you hear my voice. Because I said, if you don't listen, and you run across that street chasing a little ball and not looking around, what's going to happen? I said, you can be injured severely or you could die. I said, and it'll be whose fault? I said, you didn't listen. And to realize, isn't the same thing what Jesus is protecting us from in his words? Are they not just his life and death? And so you see this picture and what's going on. And of course, here it is, verse 19. The disciples have a question. He says, then the disciples came to Jesus privately. Now, notice, they don't do this in front of the whole crowd. And I think you know why. And said, why could we not drive it out? Why could we not drive out the the demon. You told us. You gave us authority over unclean spirits and demons. And we couldn't do it. Who's it sound like they're blaming? Jesus. If they were thinking those along those lines, are we real quick to blame God for our faults? Do we sometimes see situations that happen in life and go, this is not the way that I want it to be? And they go, why did you? And you realize, oh, is that faith? Or is that an unbelieving and perverted thinking? Verse 20, Jesus has an answer for him. He doesn't say, I don't know, fellas. He gives a straight answer, verse 20. And he said to them, because of the littleness of your faith. Notice he doesn't say it's because of the Father didn't have enough faith. He doesn't say it's because of the Son not having enough faith. He says it's because of the littleness of your faith. Huh? You can just kind of imagine him going, we're here. We gave up our lives. We're here with you. And how can you say our littleness of faith? And then he includes this part. He says, for truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, and I'm telling you, it's probably that high mountain that was mentioned back in verse 1 of chapter 17. He says, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible to you. And he's about to tell a story that sounds impossible. If we can get far enough, if I can speed it up here. He says, because of the littleness of your faith, he says, you want to know why you couldn't do it? It's because of your faith problem. It's not because of the power. Now, I want you to think about that. When you think about the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. If you've ever asked yourself, how come I don't have those things in my life? Is it because Jesus is going, well, I just crimped the hose and you can't have them right now? I gave you the ability. Why do we not have them? God's fault? Our fault. It's time for us to listen to Him. Judy. And we do have to grow. Don't take that too far. What you see, it's a good parallel. You think about, I think about children growing up, of going, there are things that you go, okay, I'm willing to give you, show you grace here in these moments because you're still young. You know, whenever I use the same illustration, when a 6-month-old slaps you in the face, it's not the same thing as when a 17-year-old slaps you in the face, right? So here they are. They've been with Jesus for a while now. And they should understand these kind of things to be able to go trust him. He says, this is something on your part and you need to think about it. And they needed this moment to grow. And I'm pretty sure that Peter, James, and John were going, we'd have been here. I can't prove that, but the conversation they're going to have later on in this chapter is going to make you think that. Now, here they are. He says, it will move and nothing will be impossible to you. He says, nothing. And he lays that out. He says, you know what? Faith moving. He says, you can move a mountain. You tell it to go from here to there and it will go. Now, but what is a requirement to have that happen? You'll have to listen to him. You can't go out on your own. Now, you'll get perverted thinking and perverted outcomes, tainted, twisted outcomes. So you see the situation here. Then verse 21, he gives this statement. He says, but this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting. What do both prayer and fasting recognize about God? It's his power. It is not mine. If they would have been able to cast out that demon, who would they have thought did it? Them, because of their lack of faith. And so here's God saying, even though my son has granted this to you, Jesus himself, even though I granted this to you, I'm not going to allow that to happen. If you're going to think it's you, I'm stepping out. He says, this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting. Prayer is, God, I recognize that you are the one who stands in control, not me. Fasting is an intensified prayer. I'm fully submitted to you. I recognize I don't need food to live. I need to listen to you. That is how I live. And if I ever have to choose between the two, I'll choose to listen to you. And you go, is this what Jesus does? I mean, what did he go up on the mountain to do? He was praying. You've read about other instances in Jesus' life where he fasts. He's regularly, look, this is not because of my power. This is because of my Father's power. Now, all these things together, and I'll just allude to it. If you're a note taker, write down Acts chapter 3, verses 11 through 16. And I'll show you this is something that drastically changed after Jesus' ascension. On the day of Pentecost, in Acts chapter 3, there's a man who is a beggar who's being carried to the temple. He's lame, and Peter and John are the two. And they tell him, he says, we don't have any gold or silver. What we have, we'll give to you. In the name of Jesus the Nazarene, get up and walk. And he does. And all these people later on in the temple come rushing to them. And you want to know the very first thing Peter is quick to point out? It's not us. If you think this is because of us, you're wrong. This is because of the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. This Jesus that you crucified, it's by his power that this man stands before you whole. What'd they learn? It's not about us. This is about God's power, not our power. They're recognizing. And sure enough, in Acts chapter 1, what have they been doing? They've been gathering together to pray. Isn't that something? You listen to Jesus, you do things his way, and then all of a sudden, look at what happens. The impossible. Now, verse 22. And while they were gathering together in Galilee, of course, in the northern part, which is where these events probably took place, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day, and they were deeply grieved. Now, I want you to notice their emotional state. The statement that Jesus says causes them grief. Which part are they focusing on? They're focusing on he's going to be killed. What part are they not focusing on? He's going to be raised. You're only going to be without him for a little while. See what happens when you just listen to part? Because remember, what did Peter, James, and John hear God say? Listen to him. And if they had truly listened to all that he said, they wouldn't have been moved the same way. Because he's not telling them the whole story here about how he's going to be killed. He's just saying, I'm going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him. Of course, he's talking about the Son of Man himself, and they know that he's talking about himself. He says, they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day. He didn't say, and they'll be raised later. And they're like, well, you know, I know in the end you're going to be raised. He says, here it is. Now, once again, if you don't listen to the complete statements of Jesus, what kind of thinking do you get in the end? Perverted. And because you get a perverted thinking, what does it do to you emotionally? Worry about the wrong things. The things that we get so concerned about. I mean, just think about this for a little bit. And I understand this thought can go too far, but just think about it. When you already know that you have eternal life in Jesus, when you know that you're walking by faith in His Son, and all of a sudden some medical situation shows up, and we become heartbroken because we hear there's a time frame for our death, it's okay to consider what that would do. But then to spend the rest of your time on earth grieving over a physical life coming to an end shows, are we really listening to the whole of what Jesus has promised? Of knowing eternal life is mine in Jesus. We sometimes do this same kind of thing. We listen to part of what Jesus says and not the whole. And I want you to notice, when you just listen to part, notice the outcome. Because Jesus, I mean, if Jesus would have said to him, all right, boys, I'm going to go away for 3 or 4 days and I'll be back. Do you think they would have grieved the same way? No. But essentially, he says, I'm going to be killed, and on the third day, I'll be right back. And then, whenever he does return, what's their response? They don't believe it. They don't believe it. Which tells you how you believe and listen to the words of Jesus in the past affect what happens and the thinking that you have in the future. So, how quickly should we listen? At once. At once. Not wait. Now, welcome to the impossible story, if we haven't already seen it before. Verse 24. When they came to Capernaum, which Capernaum, of course, is in Galilee, so they haven't traveled far, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? Now, this tax was a temple tax, by the way. And to think, they're collecting the tax way up in Galilee? The temple's down in Judea. It's amazing how tax people come for you. Now, here they are. He says, those who collected the 2 drachma tax, and basically we're just talking about 2 full days' wages here. He says, does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? And they ask Peter. They don't ask Jesus. Isn't that something? Now, does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? Give us the scoop. Verse 25. He said, yes. Peter goes ahead and says, well, yeah, he pays the temple tax. It's kind of a curious statement here as we start to keep going. He says, and when he, Peter, came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first. Oh, nothing like being first. He's saying, what do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers? Huh. I want you to kind of put this into Peter's terminology. I mean, Peter is a fisherman on the Sea of Galilee. Capernaum is on the Sea of Galilee. Peter, whenever you were growing up with your father, and he was selling fish so that people could come buy it, and you were hungry, Did your dad make you buy the fish from him before he would let you eat at home? What do you imagine the answer to that question would be? No. Now, if you wanted a special fish that was maybe a little bit better, you might have to pay a little. But he says, what do you think? And he makes this, of course, application to the kings of the earth. He says, from whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? He says, from their sons or from strangers? He says, whenever kings come along, are they heavy on the taxes toward their own family? No. What are they given? They're given an exemption. How many of you like tax exemptions? I like that. I like that word. But here it is. He says, collect customs or poll. It says, from sons or from strangers? And you know Peter's answer. The collection comes from strangers. It doesn't come from sons. And we're talking about a temple tax. Verse 26, Peter's answer. When Peter said, from strangers, he says, you know this is how it works. With kings and their children. He says, Jesus said to them, and I'm just going to give the first phrase, then the sons are exempt. Sons don't pay taxes. We're not talking about in a republic or a democracy. This is a different picture. This is a picture of what kind of setup. Yeah, a king. Kings that have authority. Do you remember in John chapter 2 when Jesus has just begun? He's just done his first miracle in Cana. At the end of John 2, he goes down to Jerusalem. And when he goes into the temple, what's the first thing that he does? He cleans it up. You remember what he talks about? You have turned my father's house into a robber's den. Whose house is the temple? It's his father's. Who is the first king over Israel in the Old Testament before Saul becomes king? God is king. Remember Samuel getting so upset whenever the people said, we want a king. And God says, do what the people want. They don't want me to be king anymore. That's what God says. God's the rightful king. And every earthly king of Judah that came in and wanted God to be king, how did it go for him? Wonderful. Whenever someone in Judah like David or Hezekiah or Josiah or Jehoshaphat or Hezekiah said, I want God to reign among his people and we're going to listen to God, how did things go in Judah? But wonderful, because the people were willing to actually listen to God, the king. Now here's Jesus. He's the king. And so here he is saying, they want us to pay a poll tax in my father's house. He says, is a tax for strangers or for sons? Peter, you tell me. It's not for sons, it's for strangers. And Jesus says, well, then the sons are exempt. I don't have to pay the tax. Notice the first word of verse 27. However, he says, I don't have to do it. However. And notice the viewpoint he looks at this at. So that we do not offend them. Who's them? Well, the Romans aren't really over the temple tax. The Jews. So we don't offend these tax collectors. So we don't offend the religious leaders. He says, so that we do not offend them He's about to tell him something that's impossible. I mean, that is impossible. Until. Remember, they're on the sea. This is kind of his, you know, home territory. He says, go to the sea and throw in a hook. Not a whole bunch of hooks. Just throw in a hook. And he doesn't tell him how big or how small. Just throw in a hook. And take the first fish that comes up. He says, the very first fish that you catch with this hook. He says, and when you open its mouth, and you think about, he says, you will find a shekel. You'll find it. Take that and give it to them for you and me. Now, remember what Peter heard on the mountain. Listen to him. This sound, I mean, you can only imagine. For an experienced fisherman, this sounds like the stupidest thing I have ever heard of. He's come up with some real boneheaded things, but this really tops them all. I doubt he really thought that. But sometimes that's the way we think of some of the things that Jesus says. Forgiveness, bitterness, anger, being patient, kind, loving, even to our enemy, being defrauded, being taken advantage of among our own brethren, 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And we go, I don't think so. And what happens to our thinking? Distorted and perverted. And ironically, we don't get the outcome we want. In the same sense that whenever the apostles were going to look at themselves rather than looking at Jesus, when they were going to rely upon their own power and strength, what could they do about that demon? Not one doggone thing. And we wonder why. Now, Peter had to decide. He's a trained fisherman. It's only going to take one hook. And I don't know if it's going to take a few casts or not. It doesn't say he caught the fish on the first cast. It just says the first fish you pull out. It says you pull it up. Can you imagine the anticipation of that moment? I mean, to throw in this hook, hit the water, and then to feel it. And they didn't fish exactly like we do, but to feel it and to go, I have a fish. Let's get this thing up here and see what's in its mouth. Can you imagine? He knows what Jesus told him. To pull that thing up and then to spread that jaw. I wonder if he laughed. Just like he said. To pull it out and to go pay the tax for himself. He gets covered in this too. Isn't that interesting? Whenever you do what Jesus says, not only does it take care of what Jesus wants, it'll take care of you too. Isn't that amazing? We could just learn that about listening to him. And then to go pay the tax. And I want you to notice real quickly before we stop. Look at chapter 18, verse 1. Look at the thought that's on the minds of these disciples. And we'll visit this more next week. What is the one question they now want to know? At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? All right. We'll unravel that one next week. All right. Just so you just kind of see this picture, Karen. Right, in Acts. right? That's impossible to happen. And so you see the impossible happen because they're willing to listen to Jesus. All right, next week we'll come back. We'll start on Matthew chapter 18.